Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Andy J Podcast.
I am so pleased to welcome my very special guest for the whole show this week. He's one of the nation's most successful and popular actors. He is a man who is currently rocking the Silver Fox look. I hope he doesn't mind me saying that, which is ironic given that we perhaps first became most aware of him when he was a werewolf. It is the national treasure that is Mr. Russell Tovey. How are you doing, Russell?
Hey, I'm really good. Thank you very much for having me. Yes, I am rocking the Silver Fox thing. I've embraced it and nobody's been that insulted so far, so I've kept it.
You didn't want to do the whole whatever they call it, just for men.
I think, well, you know, when you do an acting job, they colour your hair anyway, so it's fine. But no, in my real life, I try to keep it as simple and basic as possible.
It's working, mate. It's kind of, thanks. It's a little bit Clooney in ER, if that makes sense.
Lovely. That's fantastic. Thank you. I don't think it is, but that sounds brilliant. Cheers.
No, some people, I wasn't expecting this tangent, Russell, but nonetheless, here we go. Some people can work the Silver Fox thing, and it's working on you.
Cheers. I appreciate that.
Shall we mention the age thing, Russell? Because, of course, this year we'll see you turning 40. How are we feeling about that?
We are feeling like it doesn't make sense. Nothing makes sense. Every time I've done a job, I've always usually been the youngest person in the room. That's because I've been doing acting since I was like 11. And now I'm doing jobs and I'm like one of the oldest actors that they've got in that room. And that's terrifying, but great, I guess. Isn't that like we all get old? I'm embracing it. Life's great. You know what? Everything's been, I'm so busy. I've diversified a few years back, and that was like doing the acting, but also doing art and writing and curating. And there's so much going on that I just feel like I've got so much more to do. So the age thing just is, you know, it's just there, it's happening, and I'm embracing it. I'm not doing any celebrations myself, but I've given the responsibility to my boyfriend to sort out my party because I can't. I'm dread the thought of having to get a guest list together and organise something. So
that's really mean, Russell. I mean, this is
is it?
Oh yeah, that's the pressure. That's almost like how much do you love me?
Yeah, true. Yeah, well, exactly. Exactly. Well, that is it. It's a test. if it's a rubbish party, we're done. So, no pressure.
I mean, I love these tangents we're taking already, and I'm desperate to get onto art. But let's just talk 40th birthday. If you were planning it yourself, I mean, look, your contacts list, Russell, let's be fair, based just on your podcast guests alone, you could throw the greatest party the world has ever seen, couldn't you?
I mean, it'd be incredible, but what would I do though? I would just get a big, you know, school hall with like a DJ system and some volivants. That for me would be enough. But if you invite all them people, you need a bit more class.
It's surely the Tate Modern. Surely, come on, open goal.
I mean, that is too extra, isn't it? I mean, I'm so. You know what I realised as I've got older is that, and I've said this a lot, is that your real life has to be as important as your pretend life. And that sounds, the glamour of everything is wonderful. And I love all that side of my life. But why I got into acting is because I love acting. And what I really love outside of that is just being normal. It's just being with my dogs and my friends and my family and my partner and just chilling. And that, so the thought now of having a Tate Modern extravaganza, 40th birthday, just actually sends shivers through me. cut to November. Steve's like, welcome to the Tate Modern. that terrifies me more than excites me now.
You've got Elton John playing the piano, Tracy Emin's, you know, just doing some amazing artwork in the background. You've got Pierce Brosnan dancing on the piano. You're saying no to that?
yeah, for the minute. If it happens in front of me, great, but I don't want to organise it. I'm not into the logistics of that, no.
No, well, hence handing over the responsibility.
Perfect. Yeah, exactly.
Stick a blindfold on me, show me what we're doing. Done. Happy
That's
days.
Perfect for me. That's yeah. perfect for me.
Yeah, 40 candles is a lot to blow out. I know from experience, my lung capacity nearly gave in. So get practising. It's a good moment. You've got enough time.
Now, yeah,
Russell, one of the reasons why we've been able to get you on the show, and I'm thrilled to have your company joining us today, I'm absolutely delighted, is of course this whole new side to you that you've sort of alluded to. It's not new to you, but perhaps to the listeners of this show, it'll be something that they're just kind of realising about you, which is this immersion and passion for art that you have, and primarily contemporary art.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, it has actually been running alongside my acting life for many, many years. And I've sort of been in this polyamorous relationship with acting and art. But art has been, you know, my personal thing. I go to galleries. I'm like a benefactor and a patron, and I collect. And like one of my best mates, Rob Diamond, who I do the podcast with, is... You know, we have this shorthand for art, and we have these dialogues and conversations that a lot of other people around us don't really get. We've got this little kind of magic conversations we keep going through art. But it's only recently that I've actually been able to bring that into the forefront of my life. And suddenly I've now got these two areas of culture, these two abilities to be creative, these two zones to celebrate the best of what it is to be human, to kind of express emotions and put everything out there. And that feels like the biggest privilege ever that I've been able to kind of switch lanes and then bring it back into my life. And I'm so proud of that.
What I love about this as well, Russell, is that the way you expression, that's a terrible phrase, isn't it? But the way you discuss and describe art is so connected and passionate. And yet, when we look at other people who have excelled in different fields, the likes of Derren Brown, Vic Reeves, of course, Jim Moyer, who we know are brilliant artists because we see their paintings and we see them putting it on their social media, etc. We know that their passion is rooted in doing. Pierce Brosnan was a recent guest of yours. I've mentioned him already, you know, on the podcast. And I hadn't realised he was such a brilliant artist as well until I heard him on your show. You've had several like that. But you yourself, you're not coming at this from I'm a creator of art on canvas or on a wall or whatever. Obviously what you do as an actor is art, but you're coming at this as a collector, as a passionate member of the art observation community. Is that fair?
Well, as a supporter, basically, as a celebrator, as someone that is facilitating opportunities of discovery. So I feel like our podcast is this conduit where we're these two art geeks that sit there and we are bringing an audience to discovery. So you talked about Pierce Brosnan. I mean, the fact that we can have Pierce Brosnan on, who is James Bond, and he rarely talks about being James Bond. Mm. He just talks about the fact that we talk about his art, and he rarely gets to talk about it. And, you know, you discover, you're like, wow, I didn't realise that James Bond made these incredible paintings, and the story of his life and all the trauma that he's been through, he's been able to channel his pain into being creative. And that was such an amazing episode, because them episodes are what Talk Art is about. It's about showing how we are all creative and how we all have this relationship to art that so many people are scared of. But for me, it's been so important and so fun and so brilliant that all we want to do with the podcast and with this book now is just give people permission to have fun with it and not see it as something that is reverential and like a members club and not for them, elitist and academic. And everything I ever watched about art growing up, you would see a lot of stuffy people talking very like earnestly and quietly about what they were seeing in front of them. with references. I didn't know what they were, and they were all nodding along, and it just kicks you out. And you're like, this isn't for me. I'm being told that if I don't understand these references you're talking about, if I don't know these art movements or practices or this artist or that artist, then this discussion isn't for me. And that frustrated me. Because I was like, I love this. I'm drawn to this, but you're not letting me in. And I want to come in. And it's like you've got this guest list, and my name's not down on the guest list, but I'm standing at the door hoping I can see someone. But what Talkart's done is we've gone around the back of the club, we've found a gap in the fence, and we've gone, yeah, come in this way. Come in this way. Tell everyone, keep it down. But it's really fun in there. But just come in the side entrance, because I'm always like, what does that mean? What are you saying? Who is this artist? And I know a lot now, but I don't know as much. I'm not an expert. I'm just a geek. But I come from a place of passion. But I know a lot, and I don't know half the things that people are talking about. So I'm like, well, what is that? Explain that. Tell me that. And I think that has been the key for this, because I don't think many people discuss art in the way that is for the everyman. And the point of art is that it is for the everyman, because artists are making art for everyone. They're not just making it for collectors. They're not just making it for the galleries. They want you in the galleries. They want to communicate. They want to tell their story. They want as many people as possible to hear what they want to say and are needing to say and are compelled to say. So that is my kind of mantra for why art is so important, but all culture is so important, because it's storytelling. And until, you know, you see yourself represented on the gallery wall, you can deny your existence. And it is art's responsibility to represent the world.
Crikey. That's bang on, Russell.
That's a bit heavy. What time is this going at? Everyone's going to be like, switch off. I've got a hangover.
We've just talked about how accessible art is, and then you've just used the most incredible words, and I'm like, oh, what? Wow. But yes, look, the two factions to this, we've got this brilliant new book, which is just a riot of joy, which we're going to come onto in a second. And of course, the Talk Art podcast, which has been out for a long time, over 100 episodes. And like you say, the accessibility, just from hearing the two of you and your guest, you know, when I think, oh, it's an art podcast, I kind of, the first time I became aware of it, which was a few months ago, I kind of saw all the names that you were talking to, and I was just assuming it was going to be a bunch of artists that I probably hadn't heard of. So when I'm seeing the likes of Michael Stipe in there, you know, and Elton John and so on, and I'm like, well, hang on, what have these guys got to do with art? And actually it becomes a conversation, and I suppose this is the bigger picture and the bigger question mark about art. It becomes a conversation about life. And about putting yourself out there. It's not just about, you know, you're not just talking about the minutiae of, oh, so what brush did you use for that? You know, it's much more, what compelled you to do that? What were you saying here? Why? Where was your head at this moment in time?
And I hear what you're saying, but I think the whole thing is about balance, and it's about bringing different audiences in from different, like, you know, Michael Stipe's REM fan base will come in and listen to that. Elton John, everybody knows Elton John, one of the biggest ferocious collectors of contemporary art, especially photography, has had like his collection shown at the Tate Modern. It's like you bring them audiences in, but then you also champion emerging artists. You introduce artists that people have never heard of. But everybody has this art story, and it's just the more you can kind of mainstream that, the more it becomes something that people think it's for them, the more that they're not scared to go into a gallery, the more they can stand in front of works of art and go, I don't get this, but that's okay, because I get this other thing that I can see around the corner, and that's fine, because that's for me, because I'm engaging with that story, and this story isn't for me, but that one is. And you know, it's about, there's no hierarchy on the podcast. We're not saying this person's famous, this person isn't. We're saying, like, let's all have this conversation. And one of the best things we did was, when the start of the lockdown, I was in New York doing a play, and then it got shut down and flew home. And we'd only ever recorded in person with our equipment, or we did it in the studio. And we were a bit, like, reluctant to kind of go online with it. But then we worked out a way how to do it remotely, and it suddenly opened up the whole world. And we were recording every other day. We were putting two episodes out a week. And we have now got this time capsule, which we called Quora Artunes. And we've got this time capsule of a moment in culture at the start of the lockdown and throughout, where we talked to so many people. And it was like, how is this affecting you? How is this affecting your creativity? How are you channeling your anxiety, your fears, your hopes? What is this doing to affect the world around you, your family? But what is this doing to affect your art? And that was brilliant because it was like therapy. Because who do people look to at times of trouble? Well, you look to the people that you recognize. You look to the people that are on, you know, the news. They look to the people and go like, tell me how to feel. Tell me if what I'm feeling is okay. And the artists are the people, and people who are in the art world or creative people, are the people that are able to express the anxieties of a nation. So doing that feels like we've really kind of got the, a time capsule for this moment in history that was terrifying. And also personally for me and for Robert, I'm obviously going through that. I'm incredibly anxious. I'm fearful for my family, for my parents. I'm fearful for my friends, for, you know, my career, for what's going on in the world. And being able to channel all of that into being creative again, to making this thing and having conversations was like therapy and was a privilege beyond anything, you know, I've ever done. And for people to be so open and wanting to come on was like an absolute gift.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And what I love about this as well is that I'm not an art geek, as you describe yourself. I like art, of course. My gran used to run the Stanley Spencer Gallery, and she's a wonderful, well, she was a wonderful woman, and I, so my, you know, lots of my childhood memories are running around this little gallery looking at these massive paintings and just going, wow, this is really amazing and something completely unique and spectacular. So, you know, I have a huge passion for art, but I don't have this kind of learned understanding, as it were. So I come at this as a novice, and so therefore this is why I'm able to sort of say, you know, reading the book, listening to the podcast, it is totally accessible. I mean, your opening blurb about yourself, you talk about your connection to Beavis and Butthead, Ren and Stimpy, and Jessica Rabbit, you know, brilliant. what a hat trick.
Yeah, but that, I mean, that was my, I'm a very visual person, and that was my route in. So I loved cartoons, I loved comic books, and I then discovered really early on Roy Lichtenstein, who was an artist that was taking, appropriating comic book imageries and putting them into museums, into galleries. Andy Warhol, Keith Haring, street artists, street, like these very geometrically shaped figures, brightly coloured, like cartoons, on gallery walls. And I was like, oh, hang on a minute, I haven't got to grow up here. I can still appreciate comics and cartoons, but I'm in a high art gallery setting, and there they are on the wall, and I get it. I can see it. I love it. I want to be around it. And that was the transition for me from, like, realizing that actually I can stay a kid. You see so much now of, like, art, like adults that are collecting toys that are made by artists, like Kors is one of the world's biggest artists, and he puts out these toys. They sell out. People have them on their shelves. They're just, you know, if you look at it on a basic level, they're plastic toys for kids. But they're imbued with art history and what he stands for, and, you know, the world and where we are, and you know what's going on constantly. Contemporary, it's completely contemporary. That for me, I find fascinating. So That happened, but then I was always feeling like, I love this art, but there was something missing. And then when I discovered the YBAs when I was 16, the Young British Artists, so we're talking about Damien Hirst, Sarah Lucas, Tracy, I mean, obviously, Ron Mewick, Gillian Waring, Mark Quinn, so many artists, and seeing them at the Sartre Gallery, I was like, hang on a minute, I'd never heard the word contemporary before. And suddenly I was like, this is contemporary. This means it's happening now. This means that I can be part of this conversation. They're making work right this second that I'm now going to see in a few months. That blew my mind, because suddenly I was like, I can be a part of this. Wow. And all the artists I loved before, they've died and their work's incredible. But now these artists I love are making work. So it felt like I could be part of this Andy Warhol factory. I can suddenly, you know, be friends with these people. I can see them, and, you know, acting and art and culture all goes hand in hand. So suddenly I'm going to events when things start going really well for me, and I'm sat on a table opposite Anthony Gormley, or Grayson Perry sat there, Tracy Emin I became friends with, and suddenly you're like, it blew my mind, because for me that felt like you're on the pulse of art history. You are part of their history, witnessing it. They're witnessing to the world evolving. That constantly blows my mind, and that is why I'm championing of emerging artists, because they're constantly this evolvement and this constant, you know, the way that the world is changing when it comes to art. This whole thing with the NFTs, the NFTs, the digital artworks, it's like culture doesn't stay still. It completely evolves and people get frustrated and they're like, whoa, slow down because I need to catch up with this. It's like, no, catch up or get left behind. Mm. I love that about it. I love that about culture, that it doesn't wait. It's like, no, I'm going this way. You're going to come? You're going to follow me? Come on in. Are you not? Okay, stay back there then. Stay back there and just whinge about it because I don't care because I'm going off. That I love that.
And you know, you've described that so brilliantly, Russell, because of course, you know, in a layman's kind of way of looking at it, you can almost make this parallel with the evolution of art with music. You know, that's the sort of easiest thing. You know, are you listening to Mozart? Are you listening to the Beatles? Are you listening to the Streets? Are you listening to, you know, what's the latest thing? What are you into? What's your vibe? Where's your journey? And for generations, it's, well, who's speaking to me? Who's speaking to my reality? And often it's the people that are doing it right now in your here and now. And that's where you can see the timeline with contemporary art, I suppose.
Yeah, and at every stage you've had someone on the sidelines going like, this isn't art, this isn't music, this isn't good, you shouldn't be doing this, stop right now. And they don't. And then suddenly everyone looks back and goes, that was a genius, that work was amazing, yeah. That changed the game. That's a benchmark in history, that's a benchmark in popular culture, that's a benchmark in art history. And that's, you know, art doesn't care for reins. Art is not going to be restrained. Art is not going to be told what to do on any level when it comes to music, when it comes to writing, film. It's all about constantly evolving and the contemporary and the emerging and new voices. Because I don't know how you just said you're older than 40. It's like I'm
43.
Very okay. So we're the same generation. Is that I am so relieved that I had an experience in my life of knowing the world pre-internet, of knowing what that was. I can't imagine what it is to be in a world where you've only ever known social media. You've only ever known the internet. And that is where you live. So we're a generation now where we're kind of like, oh, we're worried about it. And this digital artwork, it doesn't make sense to us. There's a lot of frustration and anger. And it's like, why are people making money? But for the generations below us, they're like, it makes complete sense. They live online.
Yeah.
Their lives have been online from the start. So why would digital artwork not be as credible to them as us seeing a Picasso in the Tate Modern? It's like, for them, that makes complete sense. But for us, it's debilitating. It's a bit like baffling. But that's so brilliant because you then have this intergenerational cultural conversation, which then stems up, which, again, is about like, pushing everything forward, exploring the world and discovering what is out there and what is it's limitless. What else is yet to be discovered? How much more we can go? And you know this on a basic level, like so many stories are yet to be told. So many stories haven't been told that need to be told. But you look at things like last year, the biggest television show on TV was May I Destroy You with Michaela Cole. It was like a groundbreaking piece of TV. Now, there was an episode where she's a woman, and once a month, women have a period. And she had an episode where she had a period while she was on the one-night stand. And you saw it, and it was quite, you know, it was quite raw and exposing, and it showed everything of what it was when a woman is on a period and she has a one-night stand. The kind of, the tremors of shock and the tremors of like, fear and, like, what is going on there was incredible. And I thought, isn't that amazing that this happens to women every month, but yet seeing it like that, everyone is so shocked. And you're like, wow, isn't this amazing that even within the human condition, the simplicities of what it is to be a human for a woman is shown on TV like that, and suddenly everyone's like shocked and they can't believe it. And you're like, wow, we've got so many stories to tell, but yet when it comes to even the basics, we still haven't told them. Yeah. We still haven't told the period story where women, little girls, can go, oh, that's what it is. Oh, that's normal. Oh, okay. Because there's this shame around it. I remember a friend telling me that she was at a wedding and she came on a period halfway through the wedding and she had to go off and get, you know, tampons. And she came back and her friend said, oh, where were you? And she was going to go, oh, I had to go and make a phone call. And she suddenly went, why am I lying about this? She went, I had to go and get some tampons. And her friend went, oh, okay. And she went, God, isn't that fascinating that my default was to lie about my period,
which
half of the world is going through. And my default was to do that because there's not representation. Isn't, and I found that so fascinating that you're like, wow, the representation of even the story of being a woman having a period is yet to be really described in culture. Do you know what I mean? So that blew my mind. That blew my mind.
Yes, yes. And you're so right. I mean, I'm glad you flagged up I May Destroy You, because it is a triumphant piece of television. Absolutely brilliant. Yeah. Absolutely brilliant. Russell, let's talk about how you caught the bug for all this. And if you don't mind, I want to delve just a little into your childhood. I don't want to get too personal, but, you know, I'd like to sort of see where it came from, because as I understand it, you were an avid collector of, well, pretty much everything as a kid.
Yeah, I was. I was. My brother's completely opposite, doesn't want anything, but I was someone that wanted to accumulate. If I was into something, I needed to know everything about it, and I needed to have it around me. And I went from coins to phone cards. Remember phone cards that used to have all the pictures on from all around the world? I had books of phone cards, key rings, postcards, stamps. Then I had lizards, so I had lizards, loads of lizard stuff. So I was obsessed with lizards. Suddenly I had reptiles. One got out, Dinky got out, and lived on my
ones.
Live ones, yeah. Dinky got out and lived on my bedroom ceiling for about 3 months. we used to feed them live crickets, which would get out and hatch. And then my mum would be like, "That's all these crickets in the bathroom," and I'd have to go up there and get these crickets. So I had that phase. Then I collected all the original Star Wars toys. So I got really into the sci-fi world, and I went down like Buck Rogers. And I was someone that just needed everything of whatever it was I was interested in. I needed the collection. I needed every sticker to finish the collection. Then that was done. That chapter was done. Nice. I don't know what that is psychology-wise. Every other collector can't explain what it is, but it's this thing of looking after stuff, protecting stuff, being around things that you love looking at and caring for, and the privilege of having that in your life. And I guess that's led on to the art collecting, because that feels like, you know, it feels like a self-portrait. Yeah. The best authentic art collections really tell you something about the person. And they also are like a life story for me, because I look around my house and I'm like, oh, I bought that one because I was doing that play in that country. I bought that after that TV show. I really responded to that because I met the artist and he was so good and I wanted to collect his work. That artist I supported when they were emerging, and now they've just had a show at the Whitney, but I've got this work here that I got really cheap, and I know that when I bought that, that paid for the materials for them to keep making their artwork. There's all these things that are kind of, if you authentically collect and are passionate and genuine, they are a representation of you. And I really feel like, you know, my life is shown through the stuff that I have in my house.
That's
what I surround myself with.
Looking at it, it's almost like a diary of your life that's on your wall.
100%. 100%.
I mean, I've
and their friendships. You know, a lot of these artists are my friends. Are people that, you know, especially that's the beauty of like supporting emerging artists, is that you can really impact their life and have a friendship there and grow with them. And a lot of these artists that I live with are people that I know and care about and like are my heroes. And I get, you know, the privilege of having their work on my wall and knowing that I can text them or talk to them or have them on the podcast or able to go, hey, I want to put you in my book. Is that okay?
Yeah.
That, and then to go like, yes, please. Wow. That blows my mind.
Yes. But to be fair, Russell, you know, that is a position of privilege that you
yes.
have generated for yourself. You have earned it through your life's endeavors. But, you know, to the layman, to the listener, you know, we sort of think, wow, an art collection, gosh. And one of the first things I think we think of is too expensive. Buying art is expensive. And yet you're trying to dispel that myth a little, aren't you?
Well, yeah, but I guess that myth comes from looking at auctions, because all we're really told in the mainstream media is this work sold for this much at auction last night. Isn't it a load of rubbish? This work sold for this last night, but that's now going, you're never going to see that again. It's going to someone's vault. But you're told through mainstream media that art and money, commodity, the commercial side of the art world is all it really is. And unless you have like hundreds of thousands of pounds, don't bother. That isn't it. Because there is the commercial art side, and yes, everything plays into it, but there is the art world where you can really, and I say it again, the emerging artists, find artists on Instagram that you really respond to, and you can buy original works of art by them. That you buying that for £50, £100, which isn't loads of money, but obviously is a lot of money to a lot of people. But if you really are passionate and you can save that up And that feeling of being able to do that, you are supporting the creativity of an artist. You are paying towards their studio fees. You are buying their materials to encourage them to keep going, and you can grow with them. And you can find this, so because of Instagram, the world of art has opened up. There are so many amazing artists on there. And support local institutions, small museums, small gallery spaces, because you can really find what you want. And the thing is that you shouldn't be scared of it, and you're going to hate everything. But there will be one thing that you see and you go, I really like this. Why do I like that? And you've got to lean into that and listen to that and trust your instincts. Alan Bennett has this thing where he says, above every gallery doorway, it should say, you haven't got to like everything.
Yes. And
it's giving you permission to go like, oh, okay. Because the thing, what it does is that when you're told you need to understand this, you need to appreciate this, and you don't, it's frustrating. It's like they say, don't consider religion or politics when you're drunk. Add art to that list, and right, you've got a mix, because art makes people so angry because they don't get it. But they're made to feel like they're stupid, and it's only for, you know, the people over there that get it, and it's the special people that get it. It's not for you. That isn't true. Yes. It's for everyone. And if you don't get it, that's completely fine, because you don't care for that story. But there is a story there through visually, you know, that you're going to respond to.
Yes, and also you'll discover something when you're researching art or looking into it.
Yeah.
You'll discover something that you can't explain why you like it. I don't know why
exactly.
I like it.
Exactly. But
really
that's okay.
Yeah.
But that's okay. But the thing is, it's like when it comes to, like, all art is storytelling. It's like every medium. You know, you pick up a book, we get that. You listen to music, we get that. You watch a film, we understand that. You sit there, you get your popcorn, you watch a movie. It starts, it ends. But with art, you've got to work a bit harder. But all it is storytelling in just a different kind of dimension. You just got to spend a bit more time with. You've got to work a little bit harder, but the payoff is massive, because when you do get it, or when you do feel something, and when you do start to understand about the artist, or you want to know more, it's so exciting. It's like you pick up a book and you love a writer, and you go, well, I'm going to read another book by this writer because I love him. And you go, well, this writer said that he's been influenced by, like, Stephen King, for example. So I'm going to go back and read Stephen King. Oh, Stephen King was really, like, responded to, like, the movies of this person or the artwork of this person. Mm. And that's why, and I want to know about that, because I really like this writer, and I'd like to know why I like his writer and where he got his inspiration from. That little rabbit hole is magic, a magical maze where you can just wander down and you can find so much information along that route.
I love it. And just listening to you talk, Russell, you know, I think in another life you would have made a brilliant detective, because you have that sort of forensically inquisitive mind.
I am forensic, definitely. I think that's when it comes to the podcast, I'm allowed to be forensic with my heroes.
Yes.
I'm allowed to suddenly go, you know, tell me about this, and why is this, and what is that, and do you understand it? Because I'm trying to work it out for myself. I'm trying to work out myself for myself. It's like that. Being able to talk to creative people about creativity is a gift.
Yeah, and it's such an entertaining listen. Russell, let's talk about Tracy Emin, because of course she is a eminent artist. Everyone in the UK knows her. I mean, worldwide, everybody knows Tracy Emin and her work. I would say a lot of people as well know about her recent health struggles, which have been horrific by the sound of things. But her connection to you and your connection to her is quite a remarkable tale. You talk about, and I hope you don't mind me sharing this, but you talk about astral projection and visualization. And just tell me the story starting of when you happened upon her just by chance.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like, like manifestation, I guess, when you think about things or you care about something. Like, I'm someone that will go to bed and I'll walk around an art gallery in my head, and I'll go, my own art gallery one day in my head, or like a big house somewhere, and you think, oh, I'd hang that artwork there, I'll put that painting there. It's like I'm always curating. So I have that sort of visualization thing. I've always had that since I was younger. But with Tracy, I was going to a party, and I went to a friend of a friend's house, and we was all meeting there for a drink beforehand. And on the wall was a Tracy Emin drawing called Dog Brains. And it's this big white sheet of paper, and it's got this figure in the middle, and you can't really work out if it's male or female, but it's got this kind of like dog head, and it says Dog Brains in text. And then at the bottom, it said Tracy Emin 2000, from the year 2000. And prior to that, I'd loved the YBAs. I was getting really obsessed with Young British Artists, but I had no idea that you could own an edition that artists would make these multiple works in editions of like 100, 200 that you could actually own. I said to my friend, I said, where'd you get that from? And he said, I don't know. It's my flatmates and he's gone away. And I was like, oh my God. And I suddenly felt so jealous and envious of his flatmate that he got to live with that every day. He got to walk past that and have that in his life. And I was determined to find out where it was. Anyway, I was with other friends and like months later, it was the Queen's Jubilee and we were walking through East London. And there on Fournier Street, and at the end of a Queen's Jubilee street party was Tracy Emin. She was sweeping up the street. And I was like, this is amazing. I just walked straight up to her and I said, hi, I'm your biggest fan. Where do I get this print? And she went, oh, that's made by Carl Friedman of Counter Editions. He's over there. And I was like, right. So when I met Carl Friedman, I said, I want that print. He said, hey, here's the phone number. Call me. And then my parents just come up to my 21st and they said, what do you want for your birthday? I said, I want this print. They were like, what? They said, you want a print with dog brains on? I said, yeah. They said, you don't want to watch? I was like, no, I want this print. And they were like, okay. And I think they knew then. They were like, sure, cool. That's a Russell. He's never going to want something that everybody else wants. He wants that. So I had that when I was 21. And then I did the History Boys. And I got really obsessed with Tracy's work, I think, like her drawings, her monoprints. Because for me, if you look up her monoprints, they're this stream of consciousness. They're the artist's hand. She doesn't really think about it. She's just taking one sheet of paper and doing these drawings, autobiographical, whatever comes to her. And it's something kind of like an inner monologue, this energy that comes out of them that I was obsessed with. So the History Boys did really well. We was at the South Bank Show Awards and on the table next to me was Tracy Emin. And I was like, I am going to have a glass of champagne with Tracy Emin. This is the last thing I do. I'm going to do it. So I went up to her and I said, we met at the Jubilee. I got your edition for my birthday. And then we just hung out the whole night. We got drunk. And then she went, do you want to come and support me to some parties? I was like, hell yes. Wow. And it was that feeling I was describing to you where you're like, I feel like this is history happening and I'm part of it suddenly. I felt like when I sat in the taxi, I was like, I had to pinch myself. Because I was like, this for me is like a dream because this just plays into everything that I'm like, the contemporary about, like being in the moment and being part of something because Tracy Emin is, and especially then, was just like the pulse of art. She was like at the fourth, like at the pinnacle of culture. So we went to all these parties and we got drunk and drunk. And then I had to get back. I was living in Essex at the time, so I had to get the last train from Liverpool Street. And then I woke up the next morning. I had a text saying, "Hi, Pokey." She called me Pokey because my ears. It's really nice to meet you. Let's hang out again soon. And I remember being like, "I can't believe it." It was like it blew my mind.
Yeah.
And so we became really good friends. And I was collecting when I did the History Boys movie. That was when I got a good little paycheck. And I put all that money into buying a Tracy Emin drawing original. So from that point, I was like, this goes hand in hand with my acting. I do a film, I invest it in art. I do a TV show, I put it into art. And every time I got a TV or a job, I was like, how much am I getting paid? And I think, great, I can sort of give some of that, buy something with that. And that felt really exciting. So Tracy also had another young collector, a guy who was a musician at the time called Robert Diamond. And she had a retrospective in 2008. And I'd always heard about this other young collector and I was slightly envious. I'm like, who is he? And she was the same, and Rob was the same. And then she sat us next to each other at this dinner in Edinburgh. And that felt like, in the position I am now with Rob, with this podcast and this book, that just felt like, how can that not be fate? How can that not be meant? Because I met him and we became such firm friends, but we had this, I'd met someone else on the planet who thought and felt about art exactly the same way I did.
Yeah.
About, and I was like, how can this woman that we both, this Tracy Emin, how can she have facilitated this? But it's through her, it then happened. And like we've been friends forever. And then suddenly in 2018, it was like, let's do a podcast. Let's like set this up where we can just basically, me and you chat to each other about, we can be geeks, create a platform where we can be complete geeks. We can just come out and go, we're art geeks. We love art. This is the shows we've seen. These are the artists we love. This is what we've been listening to, reading, watching. And then suddenly it was like, oh, look, why don't we invite our friends on? Why don't we invite our artist friends on? Why don't we invite our gallerist friends on? And it grew and grew and grew. And then we got offered this book deal, which we wrote during the lockdown. And now we've got this book that's literally just come out that is, I can't believe it, really. And that is what I'm talking about. Astral projection, manifestation, all that, because, and fate, because you're like, how can, life is odd, but how can that not have been meant to happen? You know?
Yes.
I can't, it just feels too kind of serendipitous or too kind of perfect. And that's amazing to me.
Well, it sounds like you're living your dream, Russell, and you know, perhaps the dream that you have intended, if that makes sense.
Maybe, yeah, but I think I've always been someone that I've never apologised for my enthusiasm. That was something I learned earlier, and I've definitely got up my parents. My parents were always like, what do you want to do? Let's go and do it. They allowed my eccentricities. They kind of supported and celebrated my eccentricities. When I was 8, for example, they said, what do you want to do in your 8th birthday? Most kids my age were going to go around the kitchens at the Wimpy and you'd have your burger after. I wanted to go to the annual Rock and Mineral Society convention, which was in Howard Wood in the school hall. They were like, what? I said, yeah, I want to go to that. And they were like, okay. And we sat in this school hall with all these white-haired people talking about these geodes and agates that they'd cut up from these rocks in like Kuala Lumpur or somewhere. And I was sat there next to my parents, and they must have sat next to me, this 8-year-old, and been like, what is this?
Cool.
What have we created? But I, for them to do that, for me at that age, and always, has just fed into the person I am now. But I've always been very positive. I've always really tried to be the nicest person you could possibly be. I'm all about, you know, love, care for people, be available for people, and put out good energy, you know. And whenever I've had times in my life where I've met someone and it's been bad energy, it's been quite painful and hard. But I've had to realize that you go like, that's, you have to cut that off. You have to get rid of that, because that is like, you can't have bad energy around you, whoever that is. And it's hard, but that's something that I've been like, you got to stay, like, God, your world, your support has to be full of love, and you have to be able to give that out and get that back. And I've been really lucky that, you know, through my family, it's been amazing. And then the friends that I've chosen for myself, my chosen family has been phenomenal. And dogs, obviously, because they're full of love.
And dogs are full of love. It sounds to me, Russell, you know, just in the brief time we've been chatting, that you are an incredibly deep thinker. Is your mind constantly ticking over?
Yeah, it is. And I'm always doing stuff, like I'm writing, I'm podcasting, I'm acting, I'm always doing creative things. Someone the other day said that I'm creatively fertile at the minute. And I do. I just feel like, you know, suddenly it's like another little door opens and I go, oh, can I go in there? Oh, what's going on here? All right, yeah, let me get involved. I'm not someone that's like, oh, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to apologize. I'm going to apologize and not take up too much space. I've got to this point now where I'm like, I'm getting given this space, so I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to run around in it and see what comes from it. And I think that's all anyone can really do, is just to go, what is it I want to do? Then go for it. Then do it. Do the best you can. And what am I interested in? Then go and follow your interests. Go and just enjoy stuff and not apologize for it. I think I felt a lot of shame growing up about being a geek, about liking art, about having loads of books everywhere. If anyone came back, I'd feel like I'd had to apologize for the fact that I had paintings on my wall or I had shelves full of books, that they might be like, well, you're a boffin, aren't you? Mm. And that felt like the worst thing ever. And now I'm like, that's the best thing ever. That's actually been the biggest asset of my life, is recognizing that the stuff that I was like, that is personal to me, is actually what is good about me, is what is actually me. And I think that so many people do that throughout their careers, as they go, this comes easy to me, this is what I'm interested in, so it can't be right.
I think that's a generation thing as well, Russell. You know, I think when we were growing up, yes, being a geek was perhaps, you know, a little bit uncool, as it were. Whereas I think these days, I mean, I'm a father to three boys, and I think from what I see with my different children, you know, it is a different world these days, and actually far more accepting and embracing of alternative choices. You know, it's not just about lads kick a football and girls like pink. You know, it's not binary anymore, is it?
No, you're right. It's not binary anymore. And that's it. You're right. It is a generational thing, because the worst thing at school was to be clever and smart. Mm. Whereas, you know, I think I pretended at school that I was thick, because that was cooler. I would be naughty. I'd get kicked out of class. That was more fun. That was cooler. I wanted to be reading books. I wanted to be writing stories. but it was easier to mess around because it made the day better, you know, to be actually someone that sat in the corner and did your work and was really good at it meant that you're socially, you were kind of ostracized. You weren't, you know, respected. And I had outside of school, I had my drama. So I would be like in school and I'd mess around or whatever. And outside, I'd be working really hard on my drama. That was the thing that I was like, I've got my drama. I've got my acting outside of school.
Yes, you had that clever balance. Russell, I hope you don't mind this question, but I'm intrigued. You know, you mentioned that someone described you recently as creatively fertile, and obviously all yin and yang. Does that mean you've had, do you experience barren patches where, you know, the creativity, the enthusiasm, the passion for and zest for life isn't there, or are you pretty consistent?
I've been pretty consistent, luckily. I'm touching wood now. I think creatively fertile now because I'm doing so many different things, like, you know, before I've always been an actor and I've had my art stuff, but now I've got like 3 TV shows I've written in development. I've got the book out. I've got other stuff I'm writing. I've got the podcast. I've got the acting stuff that I'm involved in. I'm curating. I've just been doing the Turner Prize. I was on the jury for the Turner Prize. I'm just like doing loads of stuff, and it sounds like a lot. I mean, saying it loudly, that's a lot, but it's brilliant. It's fun. So it doesn't feel like work. You know, there's that Noel Coward saying sometimes work is more fun than fun. And it is. It 100% is.
Yeah. And the other one, if you want something doing, ask a busy person. So, you know, it's terrific.
100%. Yeah, that's true. That's so true. If I have to get something done and I'm really busy, it's done. If I've got nothing to do, it won't get done. And then it's so funny, isn't it? Yeah. But my biggest bugbear is people that turn up too early. I hate that. I hate it so much when you organise something, you go, right, they're going to turn up at 8. That's great. So I've got to get this done. And then suddenly at like 7:30, you go, beep, we're outside. You're like, you can't be here yet. And you're like, no, I've got to do this. No. Yeah. And then they come in, they're like, hi. And my mum, I love her with all my heart, but she loves to be early because for her, being late is terrible. If anyone knows me, do not arrive early. Get there on time or just after or a little bit later. I'm completely fine with that because it knocks me off because, if you've got so much to do, you kind of like space out your day. And in my head, I'm like, okay, I've got the time to do that. I can do that at that point. I can respond to that then. So it throws me off.
100%. Yeah, don't derail me. I've got this to do first. Yeah, exactly. And you have to set the vibe. Russell, we've not even spoken about acting yet, which is a crime given your pedigree. And you know, I should be whipping myself for this. But you know, let's kind of dive in. I mean, first up, let's talk about, obviously, theatres and everything. The world has changed. Theatres have been closed. So it's wonderful to hear that there is a new play coming to the West End, Constellations. You're in it. And it sounds utterly fascinating. Just talk us through it.
Constellations is a play by Nick Payne, which was done many years ago, I'd say eight years ago at the Royal Court Theatre upstairs, and it transferred to West End. It had Rafe Spall in it originally and Sally Hawkins, and it's a couple. But it's done through the concept of the fact that we live in a multiverse, so a parallel world, sliding doors. So in this world, I say this, but in another world, I don't say that. I'm saying it to someone else. It's like everything I've ever done and everything I'm ever going to do exists somewhere else. So it plays out that these couples, what is destiny? What is fate? What is meant? What is the pursuit of love? Are you meant to find the love of your life, or are they someone that isn't, but in this world they are, in this world they're not? So this concept of these two couples, and it's a 70-minute play, it's meant to run at 70 minutes, kind of bouncing around each other, trying to find, you know, the path of trueness, of realness throughout. So what they've done with this is that they got this in because of obviously the current climate. There's half the audience is going to be in there, although we did get a message from the government recently that hopefully by middle of June we can have full capacity again, which would just be heaven.
Oh, yeah.
But at the minute, they're going ahead with half the audience in there, and there's 4 iterations of this one play. So it starts, the first couple is Zoe Wanamaker and Peter Capaldi. Now they're playing their version of Roland and Marianne.
That's heavyweight.
That's heavyweight.
Yeah.
They're kicking off. Then the Sheila Atim and Ivana Jeremiah, who's an amazing actor, actress, they are doing their iteration of Roland and Marianne. Then we start coming in. It's me and Amari Douglas, who, if you saw It's a Sin, he was Roscoe Babatunde. He's just, oh my God, he's amazing. So we had a week the other week where we had like a pre-week, and then we go back in July to rehearse. And I love him. I think he's amazing. And I feel so excited. The only thing you want as an actor, if you're instinctive, is to meet another actor who's instinctive. That's the greatest pleasure. And he is, we're literally just like completely locked in into whatever that is when you're acting. The indescribable feeling when you know you just ride a vibe. And me and him have got that, and that was so exciting. So our coupling comes in from July 30th, and then we rep with Anna Maxwell Martin, who's obviously in Line of Duty and yeah. Motherland, and Chris O'Dowd.
And wasn't she? We've got to talk about Chris O'Dowd as well. But wasn't she unbelievable in Line of Duty? Having seen her in Motherlands, then she's in Line of Duty like that. You're just like, whoa!
She's the best. She's the best. I did a play with Anna. I was in His Dark Materials, which we did at the National Theatre before I did the History Boys. So we're talking about 16 years ago. And even then, it was just like, she's just knockout. That thing, is, whatever that thing is, she's completely got it. So, yeah, so this ensemble of actors, which will never see each other on stage, but are going to be performing the same production, is really exciting. And that will start soon. So to be back on stage in the West End doing this incredible play, that's really moving, but funny and entertaining and clever. Is going to be brilliant.
Yes. And is it one of those ones where the audience know who they're going to be seeing that night, or is it an unknown thing?
Yeah, So you book up. I mean, the unknown thing would be quite fun, wouldn't it? But you book up for, I mean, you can book for all four productions. You can book for your favourite coupling, who you're drawn to most. You can, you know, so that's all online at the minute on the Donmar Warehouse website. And then it's going to be at the Vaudeville. So it's Donmar Warehouse West End, Vaudeville on the Strand. Constellation, so that that's all available to buy now, and then you can see the dates of whatever couple you're interested in on their schedule.
It's a clever idea, Russell. You've been in so many shows, from television, film, theatre, and so on. You've acted with so many unbelievable people, but you know, we have to touch on your co-stars for The Good Liar, Helen Mirren and Sir Ian McKellen. I mean, whoa, what was that like?
Well, Helen Mirren, we've nicknamed Heaven Mirren, which she loves. And it was just like, what is going on? This is brilliant. And just filming, they're so nice. They're so brilliant. And I remember just walking into scenes and they're both sat there and there's me playing her like grandson. And it's just, it was just the best. And the film was so much fun, and we got to spend a lot of time in Berlin. I remember going out to like a couple of bars with Ian in Berlin and just being like, I'm out with Gandalf in Berlin.
Please tell me you called him Gandalf. Surely you did that.
No, I didn't. But the thing is about Ian, it's so generous of him, is he completely understands his fan base and how people kind of feel around him, that he will do impressions of, you know, being on the bridge, thou shalt not pass. If people ask him, he just does them, because he's the most wonderful, generous, and he's been on Talk Art, the podcast, and his episode was brilliant because he's a big collector. He knows, like, David Hockney. He's a Lowry, like, expert, and he has, like, Lowry artworks, and he walks us around his, like, house telling us about the art. And, again, for him, it's all like it plays into his history because he's been collecting art and buying artworks that really relate to what's going on in his life. But, yeah, to do that movie was amazing, and friends for life, and Heaven Mirren is the dream.
I think that's just brilliant. I've got a random one for you in a moment, Russell, but you have inspired me, so I'm going to ask you, you know, because I really do feel the need now myself to start buying art. Where do I start? What's a good place for me to go, right, this is who I should be looking at, because this is, Russell says this is cool. And because I want to buy a piece of art because you've told me this person is really cool. You should be looking at that, because that can be the start of my wall.
Well, I mean, there's so many routes into it, and it all depends on various things, like what are you buying art for? What are you into? What are you drawn to? You into photography, into sculpture, drawing, painting? Do you like figuration, or do you like abstract? Do you like geometric shapes? Do you just like color fields? Are you buying because you want an investment? Are you buying because you want to just have a work of art behind you for your Zoom meetings? Are you buying work because you want to support an artist? Do you want an edition of various numbers? Do you want an original work of art? There's so many routes into it. My thing would be, get the Talk Art book, because that's what we're talking about, but also because in there are so many emerging artists. There's so many artists' works that haven't been published yet. They haven't had their work talked about in this sort of way. They haven't been related in this sort of way to other artists, the same discourse. So that is there's so many artists in there for you to discover. But then there's so many other ways in, is that go to museums and see what you are drawn to and go, okay, I like this. Who else is sort of making work like this? The other thing that's really good is just editions, buy editions. If you've got no money, buy a postcard, buy a poster of a show. Gilbert and George are incredible. If you go to a Gilbert and George show, they sign these posters that are like £15, hand-signed by them, and you can have them up on your wall, and they're signed by Gilbert and George, and their artist's hand has gone into creating them posters.
That's not
some graphic designer. That's literally them. They've sat there and gone, we want this, and then they both signed it. And you can have that for like £15 from an exhibition. That's incredible. Yeah. You can get exhibition posters from like the last 50 years on eBay, some random Donald Judd show that happened somewhere, some Andy Warhol show. You can get these super cheap, you know, a David Hockney exhibition that was like Glyndebourne Opera or something like 30 years ago you can find on eBay. It might be a bit battered, but that's kind of given it history.
Yeah.
So you just got to find out what it is you like, what your budget is, I guess. But buy emerging. That's my thing. Buy, yeah. Support an artist, encourage them, be part of their development and support network, because you really could be supporting the next Tracy Emin. And how amazing would that be if that you were there at the beginning and you followed them and been able to support them and buy their work throughout their career, to the point where you're then attending their opening night at the Tate Modern exhibition and they're like, I just want to say thank you to you because you were there at the beginning. That's the biggest honour you could ever have, and that you can do that today.
That would be wonderful. And there's a lovely bit towards the end of the book, I think it's around about page 180 or something, where you talk about where and how to see art and get involved in it. It's a terrific book. I couldn't recommend it highly enough. Talk Art is really, really terrific. Well done, man.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you very much. Good luck with it all. It's going to be an absolute triumph.
If you're enjoying the Andy J podcast, we'd love a review. In fact, if you're enjoying the show, why not tell your friends? Podcasts live and die on, well, often word of mouth, so please tell your friends. Like, subscribe, review, and share. Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.